Chapter 9. In this last of meeting places, we grope together and avoid speech, gathered on this beach of the tumid river, sightless unless the eyes reappear. T.S. Eliot, The Hollow Men. I'm not going to pretend I can parse T.S. Eliot. Who can? But it somehow seems right to assemble on Eliot's beach in The Hollow Men, to view the scene of the crime, even though Eliot takes us to a beach beside a tumid river, not the English Channel. Sightless unless the eyes reappear, or sightless unless the last 8 chapters were a blur. Sightless unless we finally try to see all the implications of a toxic record, large chunks of which are now before us, and put an end to the fumbling so we no longer grope together and avoid speech. Now, much too late, we must see into the darkest craters in our past and zero in on the shape-shifting extent to which Stalin, through his infiltration and occupation of our power centers by a well-placed army of agents, fellow travelers, and dupes, prodded and coaxed along Allied strategy throughout World War II to further the entrenchment and expansion of the evil empire. The greatest undetected, unpunished, unimagined crime ever. Which is why I thought to begin this chapter at Eliot's uneasy, if not portentous, meeting place on a beach. The scene of the crime. What if D-Day were a Soviet plot? Naturally, it sounds preposterous, and for at least 2 reasons. One, simply because it is preposterous, completely contrary to common sense. However, the other reason might well be due to our ingrained habit of rejecting not just implications, but even questions raised by facts that disturb our existing view of the world. The conditioned response. We reject input along these lines of inquiry, just as our bodies reject the transplant of essential organs. The anguished furor over the inclusion of Stalin's bust among Allied leaders at the National D-Day Memorial in Bedford, Virginia in 2010 captures this autonomic reflex in action. The fact is, Stalin was an Allied leader and, as such, historically speaking, belongs with busts of Churchill, FDR, Truman, and Chiang Kai-shek. Beyond that, however, the historical record shows that Stalin was arguably the primary booster of the invasion of northern France that the memorial commemorates. Without doubt, he was its leading non-American booster. Another fact is, Harry Hopkins, Roosevelt's precious friend and Stalin's precious asset, was also, arguably, the primary non-Russian booster of the extremely contentious decision to stage the main Allied assault on northern France, Stalin's choice, rather than on southern Europe, Churchill's choice. Given what the long-hidden record now reveals about ongoing Soviet influence operations against the Allies, it is an ostrich-like exertion not to attempt to see whether these 2 facts are connected. While the heroism, sacrifice, and achievement of all Allied forces in Normandy stand undimmed, a most disconcerting question necessarily arises. To what end? Ours or Stalin's? It's impossible to overestimate the centrality of D-Day in Americans' sense of ourselves, in our understanding of our role in the world, in national nostalgia for a made-in-USA goodness that stands, guardian of our consciousness, in perpetual contrast to that worst evil, Nazi evil. As a tourist in Europe in recent years, I have found myself reflexively aquiver with pride, empathy, and upset on coming across the unexpectedly familiar names of the towns in northern Europe marking the arc of war from France to Germany, from Bastogne to Malmedy to Monschau. Due to the triumphs and tragedies that long ago played out in or around these many towns, mainly American and British triumphs and tragedies, I discovered surprisingly proprietary feelings for the area. My European friends, meanwhile, draw on no such reserves of glory. That is, these were not Belgian or Dutch or other European battles. They were American and English, mainly, and they were German. The native peoples, French, Belgian, Dutch, and so on, were occupied, persecuted, conscripted, hungry. Theirs is mainly the lore of subjugation and collaboration, resistance and deprivation, the will to survive, and eventually the relief of liberation. Even the latter, however, wasn't the climactic ending for them that it was for tens of thousands of American soldiers, my own father among them. It could be that I feel the stab of my own theory a little more sharply as the daughter of a late veteran of the Normandy campaign. June 8, 1944, D-Day plus 2, was the day my dad walked ashore onto a secured Omaha beach, a 20-year-old GI from Brooklyn, on the continent, you might say, along with thousands of other very young American men, for the first time. As a member of the 102nd Cavalry Reconnaissance Squadron in General Omar Bradley's Second Army, Private Elliot West's shooting war would begin amid the French bocage at the Battle of San Lo. Some of the shrapnel he took there in high summer became part of him forever, as did the war itself. He didn't much mention it, not to me, until his 70s, when he was writing what would be his final novel, an unfinished saga beginning in the cauldron of 1930s revolt and revolution that exploded into World War in the 1940s, his war, and continued to roil in the struggles, cold and hot, and in revolution, open and clandestine, up until the 1960s. His political war as a conservative writer in Hollywood, by which time his book's hero, a veteran of it all, becomes a professor at Berkeley, and boy, what happens then? Not a day passed, he later said, without some fleeting thought of his youth at war. Even so, with everything he knew, had done, and seen, and would read, including Nikolai Tolstoy's The Secret Betrayal, whose research would inspire a novel of the forced repatriation or Soviet cleansing of 2 million, which was rejected, as noted earlier, by Cass Canfield-like publishers as anti-communist, anti-détente, axe-grinding. I don't think he ever came to think of this particular theory. I wonder what he would say. A clear, tangible record exists, attesting to Hopkins' shepherding role in the decision to implement the cross-channel invasion into northern France on June 6, 1944, the so-called Second Front, which we know and regularly commemorate as D-Day. It shows up in his comings and goings as Roosevelt's special emissary of the Second Front. It is less noticeable in official State Department wartime conference minutes, where his is a supporting role. It is very clear in Sherwood's official biography, and sometimes, most vividly of all, it comes into sharp focus from the unique vantage point of key witnesses to these same events, who later set down their recollections in memoirs. These witnesses, by the way, sometimes seem as nonplussed or perplexed by Hopkins' behavior as I am. First, the obvious question, defensively. What could possibly be wrong with Harry Hopkins, or anyone else for that matter, pushing D-Day in the first place? I believe Hopkins' role in the Allied decision to invade Normandy could very well be the ultimate influence operation of World War II, not only setting the European chessboard that became battle lines in what we know as the Cold War, but also enlarging the evil empire itself. But isn't D-Day everything that was ever good about America wrapped into one hallowed date? Not if you look at it this way. Reinvading Europe through both northern France, overlord, and, often forgotten, southern France, Anvil, rather than pressing on from the already established Allied front and bases in Italy and expanding operations from the Adriatic and Aegean Seas into south-central Europe, as Churchill repeatedly and quite desperately proposed, left eastern and central Europe wide open to millions of Red Army troops. Unopposed, unchecked, these Red Army troops would ride their Lend-Lease fleets of Jeeps and Dodges deep into a Europe that was being ethnically cleansed of millions of anti-Bolsheviks by U.S. and British troops. All hail the true victor of World War II, a totalitarian regime with a freshly conquered empire. Russian historian Viktor Suvorov crystallizes this jaw-dropper of a paradox in his 2008 book, The Chief Culprit, Stalin's grand design to start World War II. The world hated Hitler and commiserated with Stalin. Hitler conquered half of Europe, and the rest of the world declared war against him. Stalin conquered half of Europe, and the world sent him greetings. What Suvorov describes is a world sick with fever. This was the contagion of communism, a practically biological kind of warfare at a certain point in its psychological operations. Its big lies, its disinformatia, its deception, influence, guile, appeal, and heretofore unimagined predations and pressures. It was the age-old fever of masses, its lineage in the hysterics of tulip mania and the zealotry of witch hunts, born gigantically anew in the enlarging scope of media, surveillance, and ease of movement in the 20th century. You could hardly say it was cold in Russia without being accused of being anti-Soviet, Charles Bolin had written, conveying the premature political correctness of the Washington cocktail circuit during the war. No wonder things turned topsy-turvy, as Suvorov describes. To ensure that Hitler could not hold on to the conquered European countries, the West sank German ships, bombed German cities, and then landed a massive and powerful army on the European continent. To enable Stalin to conquer and hold on to the other half of Europe, the West gave Stalin hundreds of warships, thousands of warplanes and tanks, hundreds of thousands of the world's best war vehicles, and millions of tons of its best fuel, ammunition, and supplies. Curious. Sickening, too, for what Suvorov is describing is a big lie we know as the Good War. It is a particularly stubborn narrative, as Suvorov himself discovered when he first defected in 1978. Primarily, he said, to publish evidence of his groundbreaking theory that, far from being duped by Hitler, Stalin had supported and wooed Hitler as part of his own long-range strategy of communist conquest. Further, that history concealed Stalin's responsibility for starting World War II. It quickly became apparent that the Western academic community was as reluctant as the communist apparatus to accept my new interpretation as the cause of World War II, he wrote in the introduction to The Chief Culprit. Instead of confronting my arguments the way the Soviets did, my Western opponents chose a different kind of confrontation, silence. Why? Maybe because even to entertain such a theory requires exploratory probing of the double standard that still exists regarding Hitler, enemy, and Stalin, ally, and the Good War. The term itself, quotation marks and all, comes from the 1984 book by the same title written by that lovable lefty Studs Terkel. The book is called The Good War, Amazon explains, because in the words of one soldier, to see fascism defeated, nothing better could have happened to a human being. No word on what emotion said soldier come human being felt on seeing communism triumph. In all likelihood, he didn't notice. Some people did, however. All-American, all-anti-communist Martin Dies opens his 1963 memoir with this statement. We lost World War II. It was not the brave men who offered and gave their lives who lost it for us. It was the politicians. Politics betrayed the 1,076,245 casualties of World War II and the 157,530 casualties of the Korean War. Now we are losing the miscalled Cold War. This completely confounded me at first. Of course, for all Martin Dies did know, and for all the nation knows because he personally investigated and exposed it, even he didn't know the half of it. It was the secret communist occupiers and the politicians, sometimes one and the same, who lost World War II for us and won it for the USSR. We celebrated a victory when in reality we had not won the war. General Mark Clark, commander of Allied forces in Italy, writes in the final pages of his 1950 memoir, Calculated Risk. After reading Clark's hair-raising account of an army decimated and a front stymied by the decision to re-invade Europe via northern and southern France, I understood where he was coming from. In fact, it may have been Clark's book, more than any other, that suddenly convinced me something was very wrong with history as we know it. More research yielded more chords of ambivalence and unease. General Albert C. Wiedemeyer called the concluding chapters of his memoir The War Nobody Won, Parts 1 and 2. As noted earlier, William C. Bullitt published an early appraisal of the defeat the United States had suffered in Life magazine titled How We Won the War and Lost the Peace. A new trope emerged, dividing victory into two parts, military and political. This split-screen vision allowed the United States to claim a clean military victory, as if political victory, the Soviet military occupation of half of Europe, were beside the point and somehow actually beneath our concern. Dwight D. Eisenhower famously seized on this dichotomy as something of a virtue in his 1948 war memoir, Crusade in Europe. Such semantic gamesmanship held the field for a time. At some point, however, the position eroded, and from the rubble, a supreme, unalloyed American victory rose up, a concept pure and simple, a continuous loop of razzle-dazzle, didactically enforced to this day in grainy but authoritative black and white on the History Channel. Indeed, when it comes to World War II, what endures is a rather bizarre emphasis on pure. But come now, we didn't even save the Jews. During the war and its aftermath, the obvious parallels between dictator Hitler and dictators Lenin and Stalin were obscured by a new zealotry, a new orthodoxy. A Dies or a Bullet, a Taft or a Hoover, a Kravchenko, a Krivitsky, a Valtin could speak up and point out that these two emperors of blood wore the same clothes. But in response, Stalin's courtiers by the score would turn on them and boo, yelling the magic word that turned dissenters into toads. Redbaiter! Then, suddenly, where once two emperors of blood had threatened each other in mortal combat, there was only one, bigger and more powerful than before, who threatened the world. After 4 years of total war in Europe, ensured by the disastrous Allied policy of unconditional surrender, there were no more natural rivals to hem the communist regime in at the sides. There was only us from across the oceans. As first runner-up in the war, our main prize was the good war legacy, wrapped in patriotic bunting, dressing up, disguising our radical commitment to world governance and global economy that marked the post-war era of interdependence, which Lend-Lease kicked off back in 1941. This was, after all, the Kremlin dream, the communist grail. Now it was real. Its headquarters rising in concrete and steel over Turtle Bay in New York City, brought into existence by a bevy of Soviet agents lodged deep in the vitals of the United States and other Western governments. No kidding. Think about what Hopkins, Hiss, and White actually accomplished. Gregor Dallas observes, "Thus the world found itself in 1945 at the conclusion of catastrophe, with a whole series of international institutions, ranging from commercial agreements, to exchange rates, to war credits and loans, to the administration of territories without governments, to an ambulating world without citizenship, to the United Nations itself, which had been imposed by the United States. But even more important was the fact that all the charters and constitutions of these world institutions had been composed by America's leading Soviet agents. And we call it the American century." If we can believe the road to hell is strewn with good intentions, can we believe the road to Soviet-occupied Berlin, the Eastern Bloc, world government, and global economy is too? Not now, not anymore. Not if we have incorporated the implications of Soviet penetration. Not if we have finally accepted that the U.S. government was riddled with red agents, separate and overlapping groups and cells and nests and vipers of them, actively enabling, assisting, extending, implementing, blessing Soviet strategy. In the White House, in the State Department, in Hollywood. I find myself unconsciously repeating the series of subheads from that used book I picked up long ago, those banners across the red, white, and black cover of Robert Stripling's 1949 account of his tenure at the Un-American Activities Committee, the Red Plot Against America. Back then, they looked like late-night studio audience bait, punchline prompts of hooting laughter over cartoon thought bubbles, indicating that Stripling and his boss and anyone who bought the book was a raving right-wing lunatic. I don't hear that laughter anymore, immersion in the material having overcome my own conditioning. It's just not so dirty, rotten commie funny anymore. Not if any of my argument is sticking. But D-Day? Some background. After Nazi Germany invaded Soviet Russia on June 22, 1941, the call to arms against the Axis powers, Italy, Germany, and Japan, was for an Anglo-American second front in Europe. The idea was to draw German forces away from the beleaguered Russian front, the putative First Front. It sounds good, but it was always a numerically incorrect equation. After all, Poland in September 1939, not the USSR in June 1941, was the first front in Europe after its invasion by Germany and, of course, the USSR. China was the first front in the Far East after Japan invaded in 1937. China's subsequent calls for the USSR to launch a second front on China's behalf against Japan failed to make a dent. Meanwhile, no matter how many fronts Anglo-American forces opened and fought on, to Stalin, they were all so much narzano pecheni, chopped liver. So is the fact that after December 7, 1941, both the United States and Britain were simultaneously at war on two fronts, while their Soviet ally remained resolutely at peace with Japan, until one fateful, land-grabbing week in August 1945. If Russia entered the war against Japan, General MacArthur cabled the War Department from the besieged Philippines shortly after the attack on Pearl Harbor, a golden opportunity would arise for a masterstroke against Nippon. The absolute dead last thing the Soviet Union wanted to do was enter the war against Nippon. Winston Churchill may have had to be practically restrained from declaring war on Japan on hearing a radio news flash about Pearl Harbor before receiving official confirmation. Stalin, on the other hand, not only knew about Japanese plans to attack the United States months in advance, but there is ample, recently developed evidence that the Soviets were themselves extensively involved in instigating the attack on the United States in the first place. There is also evidence suggesting the USSR became aware of the Pearl Harbor attack shortly before it began. Indeed, Pearl Harbor may well represent the culmination of the most successful and complex KGB influence operation ever, coordinated simultaneously on two continents through communist cells that penetrated leadership circles in both Tokyo and Washington, both working in mid-1941 to avert a Japanese invasion of the Soviet Union, as Gerald and Leona Schechter report in Sacred Secrets, How Soviet Intelligence Operations Changed American History. In Tokyo, as M. Stanton Evans explains, Kremlin ace Richard Sorge directed an espionage network including members of the later notorious, later investigated pro-Soviet think tank, the Institute of Pacific Relations, that penetrated the Tokyo power structure, pushing it to strike not north at the USSR, but south at British, Dutch, or American interests. In Washington, the Soviet goal was to avert an American modus vivendi with Japan, the painstaking work of such distinguished diplomats as U.S. Ambassador to Tokyo Joseph Grew. The work of Grew and others was vociferously opposed by such well-placed Soviet agents as Lachlan Curry, who were able to influence the United States to provoke a Japanese attack on itself. The shocking details about how this all came about, the Schechters tell us, didn't emerge until 1995, when former Kremlin agent Vitaly Pavlov published in Russia an article and in 1996 a book recounting his role in Operation Snow. Never heard of Operation Snow? The intelligence history community may still disagree about its ultimate impact, influence being an intangible thing, but they agree that the plot, as revealed by Pavlov, its Russian controller, was conceived in Moscow, conveyed to Washington, and imparted to Harry Dexter White. Dutifully, White managed to insert Soviet language calculated to bring Japan and the United States to war into the U.S. diplomatic cable flow. It worked. My point is, if it was possible for well-placed communist agents to serve Soviet ends by apparently bringing nations to a specific point of battle in the Pacific, Why wouldn't well-placed agents try to do the same thing in Europe? Certainly the line of inquiry is worth a sufficiently cynical examination. We can pick up on the Second Front as it was presented to the British by Harry Hopkins and George C. Marshall in London in mid-April 1942. See if there doesn't seem to be something odd about these Americans' instincts from the start. Something wrong with this picture, at least as newspaper man Chesley Manley frames it in his pointedly concise account. In London, on the night of April 15th, 5 days after the abandoned American and Filipino forces on the Bataan Peninsula had been overwhelmed by the Japanese, and 3 weeks before the defenders of Corregidor were to meet the same fate, the decision was made to aid communist Russia by invading Germany through France. Disconcerting, no? The proposed plan of attack, which was to begin in the fall of 1942, no later than the spring of 1943, they said, was initially codenamed Roundup, later Overlord. It won extremely tentative British assent, although, in fact, nothing was really settled. As Hanson Baldwin almost lyrically described it, this was just the beginning of a dispute that roared on down the roads of time, exploding now and again at conferences, never settled, always recurrent. It is hard not to be struck by the fact that even as Hopkins and Marshall pressed for an invasion of northern France ASAP, thousands of captured Americans and Filipinos were at that moment struggling for their lives on the infamous Bataan Death March or hanging on at Corregidor. Meanwhile, the Philippine nation itself, to which the United States had pledged protection, was under cruel Japanese dominion. Military losses were heavy. 10,000 American and Filipino troops were killed at Bataan, 20,000 were wounded. Added to the 3,000 killed at Pearl Harbor, there was already much American blood on Tokyo's hands. Washington, Roosevelt, Marshall, Hopkins, didn't seem to care, not really. All Hopkins and Marshall could think of, talk about, was a second front in northern France. That was true from the start, even before Bataan fell, back when MacArthur still had bulldozers working around the clock, carving out 4 airstrips in the central Philippines and 9 on Mindanao, because the general believed, really believed, U.S. ships would be full steaming ahead to bring him supplies, reinforcements, warplanes. It wouldn't have taken all that much to turn things around. William Manchester writes that in those first days of war, General Hap Arnold told an RAF commander that if 80 B-17s and 200 P-40s could get to the islands, he believed we could regain superiority of the air and the theater. Later, MacArthur would beg Washington for just 3 planes so I can see. You can't fight them if you can't see them. I am now blind. They never came. Nothing did. Why didn't the United States make the effort to get through to the islands? To be sure, Manchester writes, MacArthur and Philippines President Manuel Quezon were given every assurance that immediate relief was on the way, including a late January, early February 1942 cable of particularly outrageous lies from Roosevelt to Quezon. A continuous stream of fighter and pursuit planes is traversing the Pacific. Well, why weren't they? Why wasn't supplying Americans in the Philippines taking precedence over supplying Russians in Europe? No risk was small enough, apparently, to supply MacArthur. No cost was too large, demonstrably, to supply Stalin. Why? The answer was the American policy of what might as well be called Russia first. The Russia first policy evolved over 1941, the year in which Congress ceded those superpowers to FDR in the Lend-Lease Bill, arguably the most Sovietized piece of American legislation ever, Hammer to Hopkins to White. Lend-Lease, of course, empowered FDR, notwithstanding the provisions of any other law, to aid and supply the government of any country whose defense the president deems vital to the defense of the United States. Aside from the fact that the bill decoupled presidential powers from all checks and balances, there was no mention of any specific country to receive aid, just any countries. That's because in 1941, aid to the USSR was still the big sticking point in the Lend-Lease debate, as Sherwood put it, what the isolationists feared the most. In the atmosphere of the day, if the isolationists feared it, it was a virtuous idea. Sherwood continued, even those who grudgingly conceded that perhaps Britain might be deserving of some charity were horrified at the idea that American taxpayers might be called upon to pay for supplies for the Red Army. Maybe these political opponents of the Roosevelt White House weren't so thoroughly isolationist as they were thoroughly anti-communist. But that aside, what lover of liberty wouldn't balk at supporting liberty's mortal enemy? That was the rub, but it was no obstacle to the dirty pool players in power who confidentially signed their first aid agreements with the USSR at the Moscow Conference in early October 1941. $1 billion in no-interest aid. They didn't confess to this flow of Soviet aid because a majority of the American people, still not completely conditioned otherwise, didn't want to support the Bolshevik police state. No, not even after Roosevelt's Communism is Freedom of Religion offensive, during which he bald-faced lied that there was in the USSR freedom of conscience, freedom of religion, along the lines of what the rule is in this country. The president even cited Article 124 of the Constitution of Russia to prove his bogus point, an unfortunate reference to the so-called Stalin Constitution of 1936, two-thirds of whose drafters, as Eugene Lyons piquantly pointed out in the Red Decade, had already been liquidated. Roosevelt's remarks didn't go over well. Probably better not to have said anything at all. Indeed, as late as October 30, 1941, the day Roosevelt cabled Stalin his approval of aid to the USSR, McGimsey tells us, Hopkins warned the War Department that the names Lend-Lease and Russia should not be used in the same communication by anybody, anywhere, at any time. Sherwood put, or spun, it this way. It is an indication of Roosevelt's concern for public opinion that he did not formally include the Soviet Union among the recipients of Lend-Lease until November 7th, which happened to be the 24th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution. It was that explosive, or so Roosevelt thought. Doesn't sound like concern for public opinion so much as fear of it, fear that exposure would disrupt a secret plan. After the United States was attacked at Pearl Harbor, however, something was different, or was for a very short time. Initially, military officials imposed an embargo on all Lend-Lease shipments, called back ships just underway to England and Russia, and hastily unloaded aircraft, guns, and ammunition for reshipment to Hawaii and the Philippines. Naturally, that is, this was the natural patriotic reaction. It lasted all of 24 hours before being reversed from the top. Meanwhile, on the other side of the pond, the British assumed, also naturally and patriotically, in an empathetic sort of way, that Japan's attack on the United States would recalibrate the overall Allied war strategy. It didn't. I don't know at what point this paradox became clear to the British in those initial post-Pearl Harbor meetings in December 1941 with their American counterparts during the first Washington Conference, which is known as Arcadia. Sherwood noticed it, writing, when the British gathered for the Arcadia Conference, they suspected that extraordinary events in the Pacific might well have produced a reversal of strategic thinking in Washington, and they would be met with plans for an all-out American effort against Japan. They suspected wrong. Cooler heads prevailed. Or was that Soviet-influenced heads prevailed? It's hard to say, but harder not to wonder, Sherwood continued, noting, certainly, the isolationist press was clamoring at the time and continued to do so for just that policy. Let 'em clamor, boys, it's only the isolationist press, kind of like today's Tea Party with typewriters, only worse. Later, when Hopkins and Marshall sat down with the British on April 14, 1942, just after the surrender of Bataan and shortly before the surrender of Corregidor, the paradox must have been, if anything, even more striking. Sherwood noticed it too. These talks with the British chiefs, Sherwood wrote, produced the contradictory circumstance of the American representatives constantly sticking to the main topic of the war against Germany, while the British representatives were repeatedly bringing up reminders of the war against Japan. Hopkins tried to explain. When it came to his turn to speak, he started out by saying there was no question of doubt that American public opinion was generally in favor of an all-out effort against Japan. Hopkins bows to the validity of the opposing argument, a favorite opening gambit of his. Sherwood's account of Hopkins' pitch continued. However, Hopkins said the president and the American military leaders and the American people were all agreed on one point. Our men must fight. Vigorous non sequitur to throw off listeners, another Hopkins hallmark. That is, weren't our men fighting and dying in the Philippines? Hopkins, however, was on a roll. Obviously, Western Europe was the one place where the enemy could be fought most quickly and most decisively. Hopkins said the Americans did not want their men to be sent across oceans merely for purposes of sightseeing. They wanted to engage the enemy and finish the war. Who, pray tell, was sightseeing on Corregidor, where, in 3 weeks' time, General Wainwright would surrender himself and his forces to the Japanese? It sounds to me as if Hopkins was unprepared to argue the case and said whatever it was that came to his mind, con brio. He had only one point to get across to the British and one point only. Sherwood wrote, Hopkins said, very positively, that once this decision was taken to go ahead with the trans-channel operation, it could not be reversed. The decision could not be reversed for any reason? Any reason at all? Did he mean that? He sure did. This became evident just a couple of months later, after the unexpected and catastrophic defeat of the British Army at Tobruk in Libya. Under scrutiny today, Hopkins and Marshall's tag-team reluctance to revamp Allied policy to take into account this new contingency in June 1942 looks nothing if not rigidly Stalinist. You don't believe me. Tobruk falls. Churchill, in Washington for the Second Washington Conference, is devastated. The Russian line is holding, by the way, at this moment of British collapse. Does it really make sense to ignore a massive Allied defeat in Africa? On June 20, 1942, the fateful day of the fall of Tobruk, in Sherwood's words, Hopkins and Marshall both vigorously opposed any new operation in North Africa. Why? It would delay the Second Front. But a North African front would be a Second Front. Nope. Only Northern France counted as Front Number 2. Rather amazingly, it is Stalin's opportunistic branding of the Second Front that historians use to this day to describe the invasion of Normandy. Not only is the concept arithmetically wrong, it also fails utterly to indicate that Second Front meant specifically French Front. Our use of Stalin's lingo makes no sense now and never did. For example, long before D-Day, British and American forces massed to invade North Africa in November 1942, truly the Second Front from the Soviets' numerical starting point. The preemptive word from the Ruskies was, not good enough. October 27, 1942. Washington, United Press. A highly reliable informant who has first-hand information of events in the Soviet Union said tonight the Russian people would not regard even a major Allied success in North Africa as the answer to their desire for the opening of a second front. Apparently, FDR didn't get the message. He greeted the November 7, 1942 invasion of North Africa by over 100,000 Allied troops as effective second front assistance to our heroic allies in Russia. Nyet on your life. Stalin replied in a follow-up story on November 8, 1942. Stalin still insisting on that second front. Belittles fighting in Africa. By the following week, the dictator had softened his critique some, damning with faint praise the Americans and British as first-rate organizers, who had created both the conditions for putting Italy out of commission and the prerequisites for establishing a second front in Europe nearer to Germany's vital centers. Stalin had mentioned Italy. In our own Normandy-focused perspective on the war, we tend to overlook the role of Mussolini's Italy in the Axis, and, later, after Italy's grossly underplayed surrender in September 1943, to ignore the Allied front against formidable German armies in Italy. What's more, we always did. U.S. Representative Claire Booth Luce made a trip to Italy's front lines in 1944 and wrote an article for her husband's Life magazine called The Forgotten Front. How do you forget a front? Maybe the communist-riddled Office of War Information, which of course controlled war information, could have answered that question. Since the Italian front wasn't Stalin's second front, it wasn't news to good communists. In fact, Italy was bad news to good communists, which has something to do with the fact that the Italian front barely figured for the rest of us. The resulting historical blank ill serves the 124,917 casualties suffered by the United States Fifth Army under General Mark W. Clark. That includes 20,889 dead, 84,389 wounded in action, and 20,139 missing in action, all incurred in Italy before D-Day, by the date of the Allied liberation of Rome, June 4th, 1944. The Allied liberation of Rome. There's a milestone that doesn't resonate, doesn't inspire TV specials, doesn't draw Gen X officials to express their gratitude to dwindling gatherings of elderly veterans either. Famously, infamously, Stalin would emphatically nix an Allied breakout from Italy into Austria and Germany from bases already hard-won or soon to be hard-won in Italy, or any invasion of any kind into the nearby Balkans from the Adriatic or the Aegean Seas. This decision, by the way, for Stalin, was worth the whole trip to the Tehran Conference, Stalin's first Big Three powwow with Roosevelt and Churchill in the Iranian capital in November-December 1943. Famously, infamously, Roosevelt sided with Stalin at Tehran. Churchill was beside himself. If there was any supreme peak in Roosevelt's career, I believe it might well be fixed at this moment, at the end of the Tehran Conference, Sherwood wrote. He continued, "It certainly represented the peak for Harry Hopkins." Hopkins' protege, Charles Bolin, who served at Tehran as a Russian translator for the Americans, saw things a little differently. At Tehran, Bolin wrote in his 1973 memoir, the show was Hopkins alone. Roosevelt was relying more and more on Hopkins, virtually to the exclusion of others. Bolin continued, at Tehran, Hopkins' influence was paramount. Harry was such a popular fellow, too. When Stalin saw Hopkins enter the conference room at Tehran, Averill Harriman recalled in 1981, he got up, walked across the room, and shook hands with him. I never saw him do that to anybody, not even Roosevelt. He was the only man I ever saw Stalin show personal emotion for. The decision to abandon Italy as an expanding, leading front at the end of 1943 made very little sense, unless, cynically, the true objective was to ensure that Central and Eastern Europe remained open for Stalin's invasion. Then again, maybe that's putting things too crudely, too harshly. Let me rephrase. The advantages to enlarging upon Anglo-American gains in Italy were obvious. There was no good strategic objective to be served by virtually abandoning this theater. Not because I say so. The top U.S. commander of strategic bombing in Europe, General Carl Spatz, said so too. Captain Harry C. Butcher recounted Spatz's views as expressed to Harry Hopkins on November 23, 1943, in the run-up to the Cairo conference. Spatz didn't think Overlord was necessary or desirable. He said it would be a much better investment to build up forces in Italy to push the Germans across the Po, taking and using airfields as we come to them, thus shortening the bombing run into Germany. He foresaw the possibility of getting the ground forces into Austria and Vienna, where additional fields would afford shuttle service for bombing attack against the heart of German industry, which has moved into this heretofore practically safe area. Hopkins seemed impressed. Or was Mr. Pokerface about to have a cow? More significantly, the top U.S. commander of ground forces in Europe, General Dwight D. Eisenhower, agreed with this same assessment. At least he agreed with it before he was made top U.S. commander of ground forces in Europe. On November 26, 1943, at the Cairo Conference, which immediately preceded the Tehran Conference, Ike told a beribboned, bemedaled gathering of the American and British brass how vital Italy and Southern Europe were to the war. Quote, Italy was the correct place in which to deploy our main forces, and the objective should be the Valley of the Po. In no other area could we so well threaten the whole German structure, including France, the Balkans, and the Reich itself. Here also our air would be closer to vital objectives in Germany. Italy was the correct place to deploy? In no other area could we so well threaten the whole German structure? Ike wasn't disavowing Overlord, neither would Churchill for that matter, but he sure sounded gung-ho for the Churchillian option, right down to Aegean action. The next best method of harrying the enemy, Eisenhower continued, was to undertake operations in the Aegean. From here the Balkans could be kept aflame, Ploesti would be threatened, and the Dardanelles might be opened. At this point, in my reading of the State Department record, I reached for my copy of Crusade in Europe, Eisenhower's 1948 war memoir, to seek some elaboration, some indication of how Ike's extremely heterodox vision, heterodox to Hopkins and Marshall and Stalin, that is, had gone over. Did Marshall chew him out as he did General Ira Eaker, who similarly boosted Adriatic operations for having been too damned long with the British? Did Harry Hopkins have conniptions over Ike's Italian Balkan campaign, just as he did over Churchill's? We don't know. Eisenhower doesn't mention his enthusiastic advocacy of military measures in line with Churchill's preferred strategy in his memoir anywhere. Strange, no? Not only is it not to be found, Ike goes further still in his book, describing his position as having been for Overlord first, always, and practically exclusively, imagining only the most modest objectives for Allied forces in the Mediterranean. As he put it in 1948, my own recommendation, then as always, was that no operation should be undertaken in the Mediterranean except as a directly supporting move for the Channel attack, and that our planned redeployment out of Italy should proceed with all possible speed. That's funny, since didn't he say in 1943 there was no better place than Italy from which to threaten the whole German structure, including France, the Balkans, and the Reich itself? Yes. Of course, no one would be able to see that in black and white until 1961, when the State Department finally published the 1943 Cairo Conference records. Still, you didn't need to be a military genius to know what would happen if the Allies abandoned Southern Europe as a priority. All you needed was a map to see that the conquering Red Army would roll into the resulting vacuum on Dodge trucks, right up to and including Berlin. Even so, it almost didn't come off until Eisenhower halted U.S. forces before they could liberate Berlin, Prague, and Vienna. That was odd, too. The same map told you that so long as Anglo-American armies were on the march from Italy, there would be no vacuum. In fact, a map was exactly what a New York Times correspondent used on September 12, 1943, after nearly 200,000 Anglo-American forces poured into mainland Italy at Salerno from Allied liberated Sicily to assess the war ahead. The invasion of Italy, by the way, didn't count as Stalin's Second Front either. The Times piece remains striking for both its clarity about the map still in play and for its naivete about Stalin's design on that same map. In fact, the piece still glistens with the kind of dewy innocence or ignorance that was no match for the ideological imperatives of the communist world revolution in progress. Today, such ignorance is no match for forces laying the groundwork for an Islamic caliphate. The gist of the article by Times Russia correspondent Edwin L. James was as follows. The distance between the toe of Italy and the southern border of Germany was roughly the same as the distance between the Dnieper River on Russia's western edge and the eastern border of Germany, as James pointed out. This meant that should Hitler's Germany collapse, no longer was the Soviet army the only army anywhere near the German frontier. With the likely opening of a major Allied front in Italy, James continued, foreknowledge of Stalin's anti-Italy gambit to come at Tehran, which decimated that Allied front in Italy, was beyond his psychic powers. The British and Americans are in a position to get to Germany just as rapidly as are the Russians. As a result, he declared, there was no longer reason for concern among those addicted, especially to worry about the Moscow government's role in post-war affairs. No longer reason to worry that in the event the Red Army occupied Germany, Moscow would gain control of Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, and France. And they lived happily ever after. Unless, of course, the British and the Americans were to gut their armies in Italy to reinvade the continent from northern France. James writes, the point is that the political implications of the Russians having the only army ready to march into a deflated Nazi Reich no longer exists. So far as geographical considerations go, Americans, British, and Russians all have a chance. If Stalin was reading along, he probably burst
a krofenos ni sosud.
Not that he had much to worry about. Roosevelt, we know for a documented fact, by this time already regarded the Soviet conquest of half of Europe as a fait accompli. We know this because Cardinal Spellman, after spending 90 minutes with Roosevelt on September 3, 1943, 9 days before James' story ran in the newspaper, typed up an aide-memoire of an extremely disturbing conversation in which Roosevelt said exactly that. I first read about Spellman's conversation in Martin Dye's memoir, where Dyes notes that FDR made similar remarks to him as early as 1940. The European people will simply have to endure the Russian domination in the hope that in 10 or 20 years they will be able to live well with the Russians, Spellman recounted FDR saying at this pre-Tehran, pre-Yalta moment. Finland, Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, Bessarabia, the eastern half of Poland, Czechoslovakia, Austria, Hungary, Croatia, Germany. FDR conceded all to communist regimes or Soviet protection. What is most weird and most disturbing about Roosevelt's obdurate fatalism is that the entire Red Army at this time was still inside the USSR. Spellman's notes continued. Finally, Roosevelt hopes the Russians will get 40% of the capitalist regime, the capitalists will retain only 60% of their system, and so an understanding will be possible. Convergence again. Convergence would rule, and neatly so. Poor ink-stained wretch James, meanwhile, had no idea the fix was in the president's mind anyway, which is really where it counts. Relying on precepts of pure Western logic, not muscular Marxist-Leninist strategy, the Timesman inserted the $64,000 question into his September 12, 1943 article. What is there Stalin could gain from an Allied front in France which he could not gain from an Allied front in Italy or another one in the Balkans? The answer to James's question, of course, was nothing. If, that is, Stalin's objective was the speedy defeat of Germany. But it wasn't. It never was. On the contrary, as Russian historian Viktor Suvorov argues, Stalin wanted war to last as long as possible in order to exhaust both Germany and its Anglo-American opponents. Stalin was fighting to expand the communist empire. He wanted open-ended war to do so. He had been wanting such a war since the Spanish Civil War, back when his intelligence commissars failed to drag the Allied powers into it and were shot for their failure, as Suvorov also argues. As his joined at the hearts and minds ally, then so too, sometimes nefariously, mostly unconsciously, were we then fighting to expand the communist empire. Hardly anyone noticed, though. Timesman James continued, bubbling over with good sense. Any time or any place where German forces are engaged by the Americans and the British represents good luck for Stalin. That is true because Hitler's strength is taxed just as much by fighting to the south as it would be fighting to the west. He was right, but such Anglo-American fighting in the south wasn't in Stalin's interest. Anglo-American fighting in the West was. That's because taxing Hitler's strength alone wasn't the issue, couldn't be the issue, not if Stalin were to succeed in his territorial designs. It was these divergent war aims that were at the crux of the tensions and division among the big three allies, namely, whether World War II was for simply defeating Hitler or for saving Marshal Stalin. In terms of logic, in terms of strategy, certainly in terms of political reality, there is a strong argument to be made that to have withdrawn from the European continent to reinvade the European continent was crazy. It made no sense to Churchill. It made no sense to General Mark W. Clark, the commander of the U.S. Fifth Army in Italy, who had to watch, horrified, as his battle-tested forces were broken up and removed from the field, while his equipment, landing craft in particular, was taken from service. Typical is this entry from Clark's eye-opening memoir, Calculated Risk. In the latter half of December 1943, however, our problems increased, partly as a result of the intensifying preparations for the invasion of France, which limited replacements for battle-worn units in Italy and cut down on reinforcements. What remained to Clark in terms of men and materiel had to be stretched ever thinner, ever wearier, all according to the Tehran Agreement between Roosevelt and Stalin, with Churchill dragging his feet, to shift the center of Allied operations to France, famously to northern France, Overlord, and, less well known, also to southern France, Anvil. Last, straw-like, it was the logistical demands of the invasion of southern France, Anvil, later known as Dragoon, that put an end to Churchill's Italian, Balkan, Aegean dreams. We also find that Anvil put an end to the life of Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, Senex, the great French aviator and author of Night Flight, Wind, Sand, and Stars, and the still widely read fable, The Little Prince. His plane went down, flying a lonely reconnaissance mission over southern France a few days before the controversial battle began. Saint-Exupéry was 44. Clark makes note in his memoir of the fact that since it was his own army being destroyed by some nightmarish strategic design, his dismay might be seen as prejudiced. Indeed, there was a military argument to be made to refocus on France. In Wiedemeyer Reports, General Albert C. Wiedemeyer, one of the early planners of the invasion of France, makes a compelling military counter-argument against Churchill's and Clark's soft underbelly strategy. Essentially, when he looked at the map, Wiedemeyer didn't see the requisite harbors through which a massive Italian-Balkan operation could be supplied, as it made its way through practically impassable terrain. To be sure, this military debate remains open-ended. Still, it's important to note, as Clark does, that the disappearance of Allied men and materiel from Italy seemed completely incomprehensible to another professional military man, Field Marshal Albert Kesselring, top commander of German forces in Italy. Clark writes that Kesselring's intelligence section was completely mystified in coming weeks when our great forward drive failed to take full advantage of its chance to destroy the beaten and disorganized German army in Italy. Clark continued, "It was some time before the Germans understood what had happened to the American troops in Italy. For weeks, the counterintelligence corps, under the able direction of Lieutenant Colonel Stephen J. Spingarn, was catching enemy agents who had orders to find out where in hell were various Allied divisions that were being sent to France." Historian Dennis J. Dunn offers a crystallizing description of the seemingly incomprehensible Great Switcheroo in progress. "It is paradoxical that the Americans were insisting on a withdrawal from the continent in order to reinvade the continent from another angle." Paradoxical? Whiz through the chronology and see if it still seems paradoxical. Was it merely paradoxical back in May 1942, when, according to Soviet records, Harry Hopkins privately coached Foreign Minister Molotov on what to say to FDR to overcome U.S. military arguments against a second front in France in May 1942? Whatever Molotov or Hopkins said, it worked. Roosevelt agreed. Then again, maybe FDR was just plain tuckered out by the 6 days Molotov spent talking about the Second Front, nonstop, according to columnist Anne O'Hare McCormick, who wrote that at least 9/10 of his conversations with the president, Mr. Hopkins, and the military leaders and officials were about a second front in the west of Europe. Only shocking British reverses on June 21, 1942, interrupted Allied plans for such an assault that same year or soon thereafter. Instead, a new, numberless front, the X Front, opened in November 1942 in North Africa. It would become the base from which Anglo-American armies would fight, really by accident, into southern Europe via a series of other non-second fronts in Tunisia, Sicily, and Italy. "I feel damn depressed," Hopkins would scrawl on a piece of Downing Street notepaper on July 22, 1942, probably for Marshall's eyes, when on a follow-up London trip they were unable to recommit Churchill to the notion of a second front in northern France in 1942. Why? Why damn depressed? Why did it upset Hopkins so much when his own boss, the President of the United States, wasn't fazed by the unexpected but quite logical shift to Mediterranean operations? In this case, FDR acted with unusual decisiveness to order the invasion of North Africa. This was one of the very few major military decisions of the war that Roosevelt made entirely on his own and over the protests of his highest-ranking advisors, Hopkins and Marshall, no doubt, Sherwood noted. Given the German advance on the Middle East, it appears to have made sound military sense to refocus Allied efforts on North Africa and later Sicily, and eventually Italy, and so the Allies did. Which is why Sherwood's next observation is disconcerting. It is evident that even after Hopkins, Marshall, and King returned from London on July 27, 1942, there were further attempts to change the president's mind about the North Africa operations. Why? Imagine again with the revisionist eye. The President of the United States and the Prime Minister of Great Britain are in accord on a joint operation to counter a staggering, wholly unexpected British defeat in North Africa, and yet further attempts, which happen to be simpatico with Stalin's oft-stated wishes, continue to be made in Washington, likely by Hopkins and Marshall, to deep-six the U.S.-British strategy in favor of the Soviet one. Is it just me, or given everything else, does this seem sinister? Meanwhile, the clamor for Stalin's Second Front never stopped. So often was this demand repeated by Soviet diplomats in Washington, the Schechters write, that even officials who knew not a word of Russian could repeat the mantra, Votori Front, Second Front. During his carefully guided tour of the USSR in 1941, Wendell Willkie got to speak with an apparently genuine man of the people working his lathe in an aircraft factory. "What part is that?" he said to the man. Quick as a flash, he shot back his own question in English with a heavy Russian accent. "What about the Second Front?" "This talk about a Second Front is getting annoying," a letter to the editor dated February 22, 1943 begins, listing assorted theaters of war including China, the South Pacific, Burma, and North Africa. The writer concludes, "When people talk about a Second Front, what they mean is a ninth front." Soviet renews cry for Second Front, the New York Times headline of March 12, 1943 said. So predictably did communist parties in London and New York. "Call for Second Front. Londoners at communist-sponsored meeting urge action," another headline said on March 15, 1943. "Second Front, stressed by Amter," another headline said on March 27, 1943. Israel Amter being the chairman of the New York State Communist Party. Behold, the international echo chamber in action. On June 23, 1943, finally, a little pushback. "Second Front lag is denied by Knox." Frank Knox was Secretary of the Navy. The story concluded, "Diplomatic circles were cautious of direct comment on the Soviet demand for a Second Front, but it was pointed out unofficially that it was considered interesting that the Soviet Union was going to such pains to make its position clear." Interesting is one word for it. Hopkins, too, kept up the pressure behind the scenes. In May 1943, when Churchill again visited Washington, this time to try to persuade the president to follow up on Allied victories in North Africa by pressing on into Southern Europe, Hopkins bragged to Lord Moran, Churchill's physician and biographer, that Marshall was at the president's elbow to keep in his mind the high urgency of a second front. Again, second front meaning specifically the invasion of northern France. The Americans had done some very hard thinking since those disasters of a year ago, Hopkins told Moran, referring, it seems, to the disruption of second front plans by the British defeat at Tobruk. But Hopkins, as he put it to the doctor, was now getting results. Results? The results, according to Hopkins, were very satisfactory. The president could now be safely left alone with the prime minister. Hopkins had erected a siege wall around FDR against Winston Churchill. On July 11, 1943, the New York Times reported that here it was, finally, again, Stalin's second front, Sicily. If the invasion of North Africa didn't count, surely the invasion of Sicily did. In a story headlined, Zero Hour, the newspaper of record declared, At 3 o'clock yesterday morning, the Battle of Europe began. The second front was opened. The moment, which the Allied world has long awaited, came with dramatic suddenness in the dead hours of a moonlit Mediterranean night. Good stuff. From North Africa to Sicily moved thousands of Allied troops that had for months been in training for the initial assault of the fortress Hitler has made of a continent. Ring the obsolete church bells in the godless Kremlin? Not so fast. Yes, the people of Moscow joyously welcomed news of Sicily's invasion, the AP deadpanned, but they were saying, the AP continued, quoting unnamed masses, It is not the Second Front. Before you knew it, Second Front call renewed, the New York Times reported on July 29, 1943. The King of Italy fired Mussolini that same day as Anglo-American bombers continued to firebomb the German city of Hamburg in a week-long assault that killed 40,000 people. Russia still asks for Second Front. Sicilian campaign considered fine, but not a substitute for major operation, the Times headline said on August 11, 1943. Just for the record, at the peak of this operation, there were nearly 500,000 Allied forces deployed in that fine, but not major, Sicilian campaign. The following week, Churchill and Roosevelt would meet at the First Quebec Conference, where Churchill would pass FDR the O'Malley Report on Katyn. Hopkins would bring along a paper by Lend-Lease Moscow gun General Burns that simultaneously declared and apologized for the Soviet domination of Europe, again, even as the Red Army was still inside Russia. As we've seen earlier, Roosevelt would never react to the O'Malley report, nor return it to Churchill, but he seems to have internalized the Burns report as Cardinal Spellman's aide-mémoire of September 3, 1943 attests. In early September 1943, Italy surrendered. Russians resume Second Front plea, the paper reported on September 22, 1943. On October 7, 1943, Churchill cabled Roosevelt to request troops for an assault on the island of Rhodes before the Germans could dig in. Nothing. The Prime Minister then followed up with a phone call to the White House. Hopkins biographer McJimsey writes, Roosevelt was out of town, so Hopkins, who had read the cable, tried to let Churchill know gently that his request would most certainly be rejected, as indeed it was. Funny how Hopkins was always right. Perhaps the most amazing thing about the relentless, unceasing clamor for a second front was the fact that by the end of November 1943, when Roosevelt arrived at the Cairo conference with Churchill and Chiang Kai-shek that preceded the Tehran conference with Churchill and Stalin, Roosevelt himself still wasn't entirely convinced, brainwashed, that there weren't benefits to Churchill's proposed operations in southern Europe. Such talk filled Hopkins with sneers and jibes, as Lord Moran observed on November 25, 1943. What I find so shocking, Moran wrote just as the fateful Tehran conference was about to begin, is that, to the Americans, the PM is the villain of the peace. They are far more skeptical of him than they are of Stalin. You don't have to be an Anglophile to be aghast, to question Hopkins' motivations, to marvel at the respect and camaraderie he had for Stalin, a Hitlerian clone who ruled with blood, over Churchill, a democratically elected leader of a nation of laws. Shocking, as Moran wrote, is one word for it. Upsetting, senseless, and nuts are good alternatives. But if one has consciousness of Hopkins' perfidy as a Soviet asset, the fitting words are treacherous and disloyal to the United States of America. Indeed, it is at Cairo, Tehran, where we see Hopkins' own agenda dramatically diverging from FDR's, who still remained agnostic, if not even noticeably receptive, to the secondary operations in southern Europe that Churchill still advocated, operations that could likely have forestalled a Soviet empire in Europe and everything that followed from it. After a combined chiefs meeting in Cairo on a plan of campaign to present to Stalin at Tehran, Moran recalled, "According to Harry, Winston hardly stopped talking, and most of it was about his bloody Italian war." Harry went on in his dry, aggressive way. "Winston said he was 100% for Overlord, but it was very important to capture Rome, and then we ought to take Rhodes. Harry made it clear that if the PM takes this line at Tehran and tries again to postpone Overlord, the Americans will support the Russians. Sure, we're preparing for battle at Tehran. You will find us lining up with the Russians," he threatened. It was during the Cairo and Tehran conferences that it became clear, even in Churchill's mind, that Stalin's favored front in France and his own favored front in southern Europe were not mutually exclusive. This must have alarmed Stalin, as the record from Tehran seems to show. When Churchill discussed the virtues of his southern European campaign as an operation completely independent of Overlord, it's worth noting Stalin asked for this clarification. From the State Department minutes. "Marshal Stalin inquired if the 35 divisions which he understood were earmarked for Overlord would be affected in any way by the continuation of the operations in Italy. The Prime Minister replied that they would not, since entirely separate divisions were being used in the Italian theater. Say goodbye to entirely separate divisions in the Italian theater." The next time Stalin took the floor, it was to question the wisdom of dispersing Allied forces in too many theaters of operation, Turkey, the Adriatic, southern France. He had a much, much, much better idea. He said he thought it would be better to take Overlord as the basis for all 1944 operations, that after the capture of Rome, the troops thus relieved might be sent to southern France, and, in conjunction with forces operating from Corsica, might eventually meet in France the main force for Overlord from the north. This is an important moment. Not only is Stalin pushing to bottle up Anglo-American forces in France, it was the removal of these same forces from Italy to southern France that ultimately gutted and broke the Allied campaign in Italy, a campaign already weakened but still not paralyzed by the demands for men and materiel to be taken from the Italian front for the Normandy invasion. This, the weakening of the campaign in Italy in order to invade southern France instead of pushing on into the Balkans, writes General Mark Clark, was one of the outstanding political mistakes of the war. Outstanding for sure, but if it was Soviet strategy carried out through Soviet persuasion, influence, and an agent of influence, it didn't happen by mistake. Noting that Stalin was one of the biggest boosters of the invasion of southern France to keep us out of the Balkans, Clark continued, "If we switched our strength from Italy to France, it was obvious to Stalin, or to anyone else, that we would be turning away from Central Europe. From France, the only way we could get to the Balkans was through Switzerland. In other words, Anvil led into a dead-end street." So much history has been thrown out to craft the World War II fairy tale we have lived on. Clark's deduction, obvious, he thought, but wholly unimagined by those of us long used to another story, rips the tinsel off the tree. Anvil led into a dead-end street? How did we end up there? Were we lured into it by Stalin? Did Harry Hopkins' influence make the difference? Clark doesn't know, doesn't think that way. Who would? Who could? Who knew the half of it in 1950 when his memoir appeared? Clark points out, however, that it was generally understood Roosevelt toyed with the notion of the Adriatic operation for a while, he wrote, but was not encouraged by Harry Hopkins. Not encouraged is putting it mildly. Sherwood, in his account of the first meeting of the Big Three at Tehran on November 28, 1943, captures Hopkins' intense frustration in the conference room, this time not at Churchill, but at Roosevelt. Roosevelt surprised and disturbed Hopkins by mentioning the possibility of an operation across the Adriatic for a drive, aided by Tito's partisans, northeastward into Romania to effect a junction with the Red Army advancing southward from the region of Odessa. President Roosevelt surprised and disturbed Hopkins for not agreeing with him, eh? This is rich, particularly in light of how, once upon a time, Hopkins, buffing his reputation as FDR's reliable yes man, assured the Senate that in matters of policy, he always would go along with the president. Hopkins further stated, "If the president this afternoon decided to develop another issue which fitted into his political philosophy, and he wanted me to get into the action, it would take me about 5 minutes to get in there and fight." So long as it didn't go against Hopkins' own political philosophy, Hopkins may be meant to say. Meanwhile, back in the Tehran conference room, Hopkins thereupon scribbled a note to Chief of Staff Admiral King. "Who's promoting that Adriatic business that the president continually returns to?" As Chesley Manley observed, Hopkins was virtually accusing the commander-in-chief of insubordination, an acerbic comment, but not an exaggerated one. FDR's volition aside, Hopkins was the enforcer here. The next day, November 29th, 1943, Sherwood writes, "Churchill made one final, and, one must say, gallant, attempt on behalf of Rhodes and Turkey as strategic points. It didn't go very far, but it bugged Hopkins clearly. He must have been seething all day long, all through dinner. Stalin's treat, by the way, a lavish banquet, infamous for the Soviet dictator's nonstop needling of Churchill. After it was all over, Hopkins paid a late-night call to Churchill at the British Embassy. In Charles Boland's account, he writes that Hopkins told the Prime Minister that he was fighting a losing battle to try to delay the invasion of France. Says which man's army? The question doesn't seem to have come up. Hopkins, via Boland, continued, "The view of the United States about the importance of an assault across the Channel had been firmly fixed for many months," Hopkins said, "and the Soviet view was equally adamant." There was really little Churchill could do, Hopkins emphasized, in advising the Prime Minister to yield with grace. I think it's time to vent. Who was Harry Hopkins to advise the Prime Minister of England to yield with grace or otherwise? Was he just a heartland Napoleon? Or was this the KGB's Agent 19 speaking? Notably, there is no mention of this visit in Sherwood, in State Department records, in Churchill's own accounts, in McGimsey's biography of Hopkins, in Moran's biography of Churchill, or in any other record I have come across. Just Boland's. Maybe Hopkins hoped it would remain a secret, too. Boland continued, "It is still not clear whether Hopkins acted under Roosevelt's instructions in going to Churchill. I was not privy to Hopkins' talks with Roosevelt or with Harriman. But at that time, Roosevelt was relying more and more on Hopkins, virtually to the exclusion of others. At Tehran, Hopkins' influence was paramount." What Boland seems to be saying is it almost didn't matter whether Franklin sent Harry to Winston to tell him to lay off. What Harry said went, and virtually to the exclusion of others. Personally, I don't believe Hopkins was in this case acting under Roosevelt's instructions. There is no evidence that FDR felt inhibited about expressing himself to his British counterpart. Nonetheless, the next morning, Tuesday, November 30th, 1943, the Anglo-American Combined Chiefs met and agreed to launch Overlord in May 1944 to invade southern France on as big a scale as landing craft permit, sucking Italy dry, and to cap operations in Italy. Any decisions about Aegean operations were deferred. In other words, it was the end of Aegean operations. At the luncheon that followed, Stalin was most pleased. Roosevelt, too. Churchill was beside himself. Days later, ill, manic, exhausted, a 68-year-old Winston Churchill insisted on planning a trek to Italy to visit Alex, General Harold Alexander, commander of Allied forces in Italy. This drew a medical rebuke from his physician. "I told him it was madness to set off on a journey when he was under the weather like this," Moran recalled. "At that, he lost his temper. 'You don't understand. You know nothing about these things. I am not going to see Alex for fun. He may be our last hope. We've got to do something with these bloody Russians.'" At the time, Moran put this episode down to Churchill's cussedness. Writing in his memoirs published more than 20 years later, Moran continued, "But now I wonder if, whether it was the first indication that Winston had arrived at the conclusion that if he wanted to help the countries of Eastern Europe, he must get there before the Red Army. It was probably already too late. Soon it would be past the 11th hour in Wiedemeyer's eyes. In the last stage of the war, the American general wrote, Churchill didn't have a chance at saving anything. The American chiefs were running the show, under orders from Roosevelt, later Truman, to smash Germany's armed forces and adhere to the agreements made with Stalin, even though he had already broken them in Poland. The great Churchill had been marginalized. Is it possible that in marginalizing Winston Churchill, defusing the threat to the Soviet Union posed by an Allied advance on Germany from Central Europe, Hopkins had executed the biggest influence operation of his career? Conversely, did Winston Churchill, finding himself odd man out, ever wonder whether he had stepped into a vortex of secret forces beyond his ken and control? These are questions to ponder on the sands of Omaha, Juneau, and Sword. Quite possibly the mechanism of the greatest influence operation ever. There is a case to be made that Hopkins himself saw this coup as mission accomplished. After Tehran, Hopkins returned to Washington to a new life, a new routine, moving out of the White House and into a home in Georgetown with his wife Louise and daughter Diana. It seems hard to believe Hopkins would have let himself be maneuvered out of those White House digs if he still had real reason to be there. On the other hand, I've read reports indicating there was friction in the blended ménage of Hopkins's and Roosevelt's, which may have prompted the move. There's just not much record to go on here. The subject almost becomes moot when, just a few weeks later, on New Year's Day, 1944, while having a fine time with friends, as Sherwood tells us, Hopkins seemed to droop and had to go to bed. His collapse was no passing thing. Hospitalized first at Naval Hospital, then at the Mayo Clinic for another severe operation, Hopkins would convalesce in White Sulphur Springs for months. All told, Harry Hopkins was away for 7 months before returning to Washington on the 4th of July, 1944. Not to worry. There was plenty of damage left in Hopkins. Still, committing the crime of the century takes a lot out of a man.